We've been speaking for a handful of weeks now about bodhisattva practice and some of the ideas around vastness, the nature of who we are, that arose in the kind of early middle period of the Buddhist teachings, after the first layer of teachings that established the basic wisdom teaching that Buddhism would become deeply known for, the teachings on the nature of our experience as constantly changing. Because of that constant change, inherently unsatisfying in a certain lasting way, and as an implication of those, especially of change, the unfindability of a kind of permanent, eternal soul or essence in anything, including selves. And in the earliest system, this was part of an orientation toward deep unbinding of the individual heart from the, we might say, ancient habits or ancient demons, to personify it more, of grasping and fearing the world, greed, hatred, and delusion, or lust, anger, and confusion, as deeply embedded tendencies that course through our body, because they course through our families, because they course through our communities, our cultures, our world. And so the Buddha's profound insight into this aspect of the human condition, that it's painful in a way that is impossible to remedy through material action, right? Like getting materially comfortable, getting rich, or being protected from overt harm, doesn't actually protect one from suffering, from pain, from the pain of loss, from the realities of old age and sickness and death, as we chant in the opening puja. And so the diagnosis of this kind of suffering based in the ancient demons of greed and hatred, delusion, ignorance. The prescription then is the practice of finding freedom in the individual heart, in our own orientation to the world, by letting go in a stunning kind of way, like letting go of clinging to anything, and mostly this means to ideas, really, to the idea or feeling of being a certain kind of thing, or experiences being a certain kind of thing. With this as the foundation, then, of Buddhist teaching, and really still the centerpiece of what we try to do here. Like, we sit in meditation, we gather our faculties, and we encounter ourselves in this way, where as we practice, we might begin to see with some clarity the unfolding stream of experience. Oh, now I'm upset, now I'm happier, now I'm distracted by this thing, now I'm more focused. We might begin to see how out of our control this is. We try to focus and we can't. Sometimes we don't try at all and focus happens. So much, we put so much effort into like trying to be disciplined or trying to improve our situation in life. And our efforts come to fruition or not, or in various ways, depending not just on what we bring, but all of the conditions around us. Right? You try to act with clarity, speak with clarity, but the people you're around are a mess, right? I mean, not like you're not, but you know, one of the main distinctions in spiritual practice, in a certain way, but we could also just say in you know, self-improvement or cultivation practice. Like, you could think this about therapy as well. You could say, oh, the world is divided into people who are in therapy and people who aren't. Where the only distinction really is that the folks in therapy are trying to do something about their misery, and the folks who aren't in the same way. But you could say that about anything, people who go to the gym, people who meditate, you know, whatever. So the core dynamic is, like, are you trying to do something about it? Are you attempting to resolve dissatisfaction in your own heart? And I would basically say, like, well, everyone's attempting to do that. Some people are attempting through, you know, cultivating a long-term relationship with, you know, alcohol, right? An unskillful way or a harmful way to try to defeat the demon of dissatisfaction. Others by really trying to, you know, practice yoga or meditation or something to heal. A more skillful, more wholesome way to try to defeat that demon. So maybe we're all trying to do this, and the Buddha says that this method of letting go, of releasing, practicing releasing our ideas and habits around what the attempt to be happy through means that can't provide that happiness. Letting go of that and resting into the flow of experience in a way that flow isn't contracted around with the force of grasping. This tradition says that's the way, that's the pathway to freeing the heart. With that as the foundation, the tradition unfolded in flowering kind of layers of thought and inspiration and religious feeling. And one of those layers we've been looking at lately, called the Perfection of Wisdom, the Prajnaparamita texts, and we've been reading this gorgeous text called the Diamond Sutra. And the Diamond Sutra revolves around an idea of a kind of being called a bodhisattva. Bodhi means awake, sattva, being. Bodhi also means awake in the sense of, like, enlightened or realized or awakened. So bodhisattva, enlightened being, or being in the process of enlightenment. The word bodhisattva, started to be used in the earliest layer of the Buddhist texts that we have, as a word that Gautama, the Buddha, would use to refer to himself before he got enlightened. So he would say, back when I was still an unawakened or unenlightened bodhisatta, that's the Pali version, I did this or that. You know, I was at home in my palaces, or I left home, I practiced in this way, I was seeking in this way through many lifetimes as a bodhisattva. So originally, it seems like that word meant almost like a Buddha in training. Someone who was in the process of trying to awaken fully, but hadn't done so yet. As that concept evolved, it turned into not just that, but actually, in a way, that same archetype, like a bodhisattva is one working toward becoming a Buddha, but really vastly expanded in its importance. And to have a sense of what's happening here, I'm going to give you a few kind of obscure ancient words for enlightened beings. So in the early layer of texts, in the Pali texts, when an individual accomplishes this complete letting go, really understands the nature of the self as being nothing solid, nothing that can be found or essentialized, lets go of grasping fully, grasping to aspects of the self that get constricted or bound. When a being does this, they can become what's called accomplished or perfected. And the word is arhant. They become an arhant, and it becomes a name for a kind of being. And so the early texts would say, you know, the Buddha was teaching at this place, and with him were lots of monastics, monks and nuns, laymen, laywomen, and among them were many arhants. And arhants means, you know, people who have practiced, and in the earliest system they were all monastics, almost entirely, who had practiced to the point of full liberation. And arhant is considered the end of the path. You're done. As the tradition continues, so that's one term, the arhant. The Buddha, Gotama, or the sage of the Sakyas, Sakyamuni, Sakya was his clan, so the sage of the Sakya clan, didn't use the word Buddha for himself. That came somewhat later, the awakened one. He used the word Bodhisatta to refer to himself before enlightened, so like when he was practicing for many, many lifetimes before his final lifetime or birth. And for himself, after becoming awakened, he used the mysterious word Tathagata, which means the one thus gone, which is a very strange mystical term. I won't go into that term much tonight, but it's an interesting word that says, you know, something like, I'm so liberated that there's not even really a thing to call a self here. So I'm just going to say, like, this that is the experience of being, you know, fully released. Call it Tathagata. As the tradition matured, there developed several other terms for enlightened beings. And one of them, an interesting one that doesn't get a lot of play, we almost never talk about it, is a category of enlightened being called the Pratyeka Buddha. And the Pratyeka Buddha is called the solitary or independent Buddha. And this has been around since the earliest layer of the teachings. This is a being who is fully enlightened, like a Buddha, but who has no teacher, who came upon that enlightenment entirely kind of spontaneously or individually, like they found it themselves, and they then do not teach. They're invisible Buddhas. They just go about their life being fully liberated. They don't do anything visible. This is a really good category to have in the system, because it proposes that it actually might be quite common or possible to do this. These people are everywhere, perhaps, or maybe they're quite rare, but you don't know. You don't know who they are. And it makes this wonderful sort of situation possible, at least logically, that you know several of them. But you just can't quite tell. You might think that someone's really a mess, but that might just be you projecting your mess on them. And they're just, you know, pretending to be an ordinary person, but they're a Pratyeka Buddha. They're just like a solitary, liberated Buddha. And it's this beautiful sort of middle ground figure. And then there's the Samma Sambuddha, the fully self-awakened Buddha that we chant to. As the Bodhisattva archetype developed, then there ends up being this distinction made between Bodhisattvas, so beings who vow to become a Buddha, but not to become an arhant, the early ideal of the individual enlightened being, but also not to become a Pratyeka Buddha, right? To become a fully enlightened Buddha, Samma Sambuddho. And that wish to become a fully enlightened Buddha would be based in a strong feeling of empathy or compassion, a powerful wish to free others, to liberate others. We talked about this a couple weeks ago, the wish to liberate all beings everywhere, and to somehow to make a wish that's so impossibly vast, all beings everywhere in all time and space, in any conceivable kind of birth, I will liberate them all. This crazy thing to wish. And so then the bodhisattva wishes that, but then to do that, you have to not just become liberated yourself, but actually gain this extraordinary amount of kind of spiritual power. And I think the main distinction that was noticed was that the arhants, the sages from the earliest tradition, would be fully liberated, but the reach of their liberation might be, you know, somewhat great, like maybe they had thousands of students, or it might be quite small, like they might just be liberated and not do that much. They're just done. And it was considered very virtuous to just be done, you know, and live a life as a beautiful example of the spiritual life. So then there arises this idea that's okay, but that it's a much bigger thing to do, and a much more generous thing to do, and a much more compassionate thing to do, to not wish for that particular liberation, that individual, solitary, being done, I let go fully liberation, but to bypass that and choose to be reborn again and again and again and again and again for countless lifetimes while you build up the spiritual power or force that makes one become an actual Buddha. And so then the distinction was made, like, oh, what's... This question was asked philosophically, well, what's the difference between the Buddha and the arhants? The Buddha, this teacher, founded this whole thing, this incredible, powerful being, and the arhants. And the answer was very interesting. The answer was, their degree of liberation is the same. They're both fully liberated from greed, hatred, and delusion. But the Buddha has this extra set of power, this amount of force that he or she can manifest in the world, that has the force to be able to liberate countless beings. And you could think about it this way, like, you know, one of the early arhants, the name was Shariputra, or Sariputta, fully liberated, known as the foremost in wisdom in the early school, deeply wise, deeply accomplished, vastly free, had thousands of students, affected the lives of many. We still remember, we still tell his story as part of the early discourses. But how many people really have heard of him, really have their hearts moved, their lives affected by this person, versus the number of people who have heard of and have their lives affected by the Buddha himself? A vast difference. So what was different about those two people? The Buddha somehow had in their being the kind of momentum that would cause this huge ripple effect in the world. Right? It's said, like, when a Buddha appears in a cosmic eon, that's a blessed eon. That's an amazing time that a being like that appeared, taught, established the momentum of their teaching, and that momentum sustains for a very long time. Not forever, but a very long time. It says that eventually, even that incredible blessing, karma, dissolves, gets done. And then the Buddha Dharma can disappear from the world. One of the early texts says, as soon as there's a generation where nobody becomes enlightened and nobody respects concentration, the Dharma is on its way out. Pretty soon it's just empty forms and rituals and kind of surface level practices that don't really reach the depth. And once that starts to happen, it's the beginning of the end. That's supposed to be inspiring to you, to be like, like, it's on... It's a little depressing also. You look around the world, lots of end of the Dharma going on. But it's not actually true yet. There are absolutely beings awakening fully. There are absolutely beings respecting concentration, practicing very deeply, giving their whole lives to practice. And but it's on every single generation to produce some of those beings. So then this ideal arises that it's this amazing thing to do, to make a vow to be a bodhisattva. It's called the Bodhisattva vow, right? I vow to not enter full liberation until I'm able to save all beings, to bring all beings with me. And so this is an ancient doctrine. This is a conversation essentially about how seekers should best orient themselves on a liberation path. This conversation goes back to about the, you know, a few centuries before the Common Era. The Buddha was like 500 BCE. This conversation about bodhisattvas and bodhicitta and enlightened action, postponing liberation for full Buddhahood, this starts to really get some momentum around 100 BCE or so. Goes on for a long while. Here we are. A lot of centuries later, still talking about it. That's some force, right? That's a lot of momentum that this idea has had. And one of the interesting current manifestations of this conversation is sort of the reason that I'm talking about this whole tradition and bodhisattvas at all right now, is that the figure of the bodhisattva has been taken up in the kind of convert Buddhist communities in North America and Europe primarily, as a way to talk about or value engaged social action in a kind of opposition to internal renunciate action. And so there arose relatively early on in Buddhist history a critique of the arhats and the early practitioners of liberation, that they were turning away from the world in a certain way. And that critique is both inaccurate and a caricature, and also accurate in some ways. In a very fundamental way, the thing the Buddha proposed doing, let go profoundly, deeply to anything that might bind you, is very much in a certain way a turning away from the aspect of the world that is bound up in greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, think of it this way, right? You've got your home, your job, your family, your people, the activities you do, all of that. And what might happen if you no longer felt like you needed to accomplish anything at all in the world? If you didn't grasp at anything, if you didn't grasp at relationships, if you didn't grasp at material resources, if you were content to live on nearly nothing, you have essentially two outfits so that you can wear one while you're washing the other, essentially, but they're identical. You have a couple of robes, essentially, sheets to wear. You have one bowl, toothbrush, one spoon, if you use one. And every day you walk around with your bowl, and people put things in it, and you eat whatever gets put in it, and if nothing gets put in it, you don't eat, and you've let go. You don't earn money, you don't have sex, you're not trying to get entertained, you don't bother with music or the news. You live in the most radically simple way possible for the human animal, essentially. And in doing so, letting go that deeply of your material connections, you work on the inner demons of greed, hatred, and delusion. Letting go, letting go, letting go. Until it's just clear that you don't need anything, actually, to be happy. Happiness doesn't come from getting anything. That was always a trick being played on us somehow. But that there's actually a profound ease and happiness, and even like, not just happiness, but like a kind of satisfaction or the answer to the mystery of why we're here or what this life is, that is found by not trying to fix anything. And when that happens, the heart just releases. Sometimes dramatically, sometimes slowly and gradually over the course of decades. And this is totally possible. You can do this. You can do it now. But the critique arose that although that's true, you can do that, and it's almost the best thing you can possibly do in a certain way. Right? Stop causing harm in the world. Stop doing actions that hurt others out of your confusion and fear and longing for a kind of security. The critique was that to do that involved a kind of turning away from the suffering of others. And it's true that in a certain way it does. The arhants, those practicing for an individual liberation, may have their heart vastly open to the suffering of the world. But the liberation is in a sense, an internal process. And I think that's always true, even as the system evolved toward the bodhisattva archetype. But the critique arose that orienting yourself toward the suffering of others was actually a beautiful and necessary thing to do. And it was also a possible path to liberation, but it was a longer one. Because it takes a lot more, I'm calling it sort of spiritual power or force, to develop the powers of a Buddha that could liberate so many people. How many people have become enlightened through the action of the Buddha? Countless over these millennia. Or maybe countable, but not able, that we don't have the data. Today was a big day for data science. Mark Zuckerberg on Capitol Hill, if you listened to any of that. In an interesting way, this is totally a digression into politics, but in an interesting way, the whole conversation, which was frustrating in that it was steeped in fear and greed and hatred, but actually had some really interesting philosophical underpinnings. I wish they would just have the philosophical conversation that would go something like, the nature of relationship is connection. Connection can be abused. How do you know how much connection to invite but still protect from abuse? The more connection you invite, the more possibility for abuse, because they must go together. The more contact, the more contact, period, right? But what do we know about people? One of the things we have, either, I don't know if there were any Buddhists in the room, who knows? What do we know about people? It's like, well, greed, hatred, and delusion, to use the old terms, is what people express, along with love and kindness and generosity and all the good stuff. Therefore, if you build a system that connects more people to more people, you're going to get a mix of greed, hatred, and delusion, and love and kindness and generosity and all that stuff. So, you know, and there's other conversations important. I don't know that anyone said the word, you know, like, I don't, what to say, post-colonial global capitalism? I don't know, right? There's a whole conversation there to be had. But it was a day about data. And data says something like, how do I read this back in? That if your orientation is toward others in a vast way, the process of becoming clear in relation to them is exponentially more difficult than becoming clear just in yourself. Yeah? And I think that was the shift that happened between the ideal of the arhant, like, you can get liberated, just do this, to the vow, don't get liberated, vow to liberate everyone. But that means you become a very different kind of being in the world. So then this archetype has become taken up by the social justice folks and the folks concerned with social action, because it proposes that it's possible to work toward liberation by caring for others. The bodhisattva is one who engages in social action in a certain way. And this is important, although challenging. And the main challenge I'll say about it, and we'll talk about this more kind of as we go forward, one of the main challenges is that the process of purification of the heart, the process of uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion from our own hearts, continues to be an issue, even if we make the vow to liberate others. And so then we start to have this a challenge that perhaps the more renunciate end of the spectrum didn't have as much. If you're being a full renunciate, right, begging for all, you're a monk or a nun, you're begging for alms, you own nothing, you do very little relationally other than within the monastic community that you live in. And you can really focus on just uprooting these torturous qualities from your own heart. But you know, if as soon as you would try, if you would try to do something bigger, you know, feed people, take care of people, offer to, even as soon as you start to teach, you have to exit the bubble of your own healing process and deal with others in their woundedness. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you do that, your path is much more complex. Because you can't hide, in a way, from the demons of the world. And in a beautiful sense, you're choosing not to. That's the great vow of it. I'm choosing not to seclude myself from other people's demons, basically. So let's say there's a spectrum, we talked about this maybe last week or the week before, I'm not sure, between inwardness and outwardness, or renunciation and engagement. This was last week. Where at one end of the spectrum, most of my energy or my attentional faculties is turned inward. And at the other end of the spectrum, most of them are turned outward. The virtue of the fully turned inward is that there's a relatively clear path toward liberation. The virtue of the turn outward is that those of us who care, beings who care about others, are desperately needed in this world. Like, we need people to do that. And if you have it in your heart to care for others and to want to serve, then, you know, the world needs you to do that. There's a vast need for help. The shadow side of the turning inward is a kind of dissociation or bypass, right? Ignoring the suffering of the world, a kind of ostrich in the head in the sand sort of approach. The shadow side of the turning outward is that you may, the need is so great, the need is actually unfillable. Like, you can't save everyone in a material way, in a psychological way, in a personal way, in a social action way. It's impossible to fix the system fully and permanently. Therefore, burnout is the shadow, and being overextended and forgetting oneself. And the activist world is full of this, particularly because folks who feel that it is so imperative to work on the social ills are very often folks who suffered from those ills. Right? People work on social issues that affected them, which is appropriate, but it also means that the service sector is full of traumatized folks who are trying to fight against the very thing that traumatized them by working on it. The renunciate sector is also full of traumatized folks in a different way, right? The folks who were actually wounded by contact in a certain way might be drawn to the inward paths. Yeah. Hi, my name is Sean. I'm a wounded introvert. Therefore, I became a monk. Hi, Sean. You know, like, that's my parody of a certain realm of confessional practice out there. But, you know, like, I was kind of shut down and depressed. And when I stumbled upon, in my mid-20s, this thing where you could, like, not talk to anybody, not look at them, not touch them, sit in silence, be cooked for, have to do very simple tasks, and not do much else for long periods of time, I was like, that sounds great. That's totally where I want to be. And when I went off to be a monk, it was tremendously difficult being a monk. But it was difficult because the inner demons are difficult. The life itself was pretty chill, actually. Other than the getting dengue fever part, which I did in there. So that was unpleasant. But the rest was really like, oh, I can really do this. Just sit and walk, eat one meal, be mostly alone, get taken care of. It's a fine life for an introvert. Somehow the karmic machine spit me back out. And here I am with a toddler. And cheers to that. But so the social action communities have hooked onto the idea or the ideal of the Bodhisattva because it proposes that engagement and care for others is part of the spiritual path. Both sides have their shadow. And the practice of being a bodhisattva, if we go back to the early archetype, is not actually of one who abandons the spiritual path in order to care for others, kind of a sort of religious social worker archetype. But we've been reading the Diamond Sutra, and the archetype of the Bodhisattva is actually one who vows to save all beings everywhere throughout all time and space by becoming a Buddha. And so that means that actually the ancient archetype is not the archetype of one who lets go of renunciation, lets go of individual liberation, and only serves like the material or social well-being of others. It's actually an archetype of one who lights a fire under their ass for liberation because they realize that only the profoundly powerful liberation of a Buddha will be enough to have the kind of effect that they want to have. And so then I think it actually sits somewhere in the middle of those two extremes. And of course it's embedded within a system of thought, or it would become... it weaves through another system of thought called the Madhyamaka that we're not talking about, but we could at some point soon, that speaks very specifically to finding a middle way between extremes. What, for you, might be the middle way between giving attention to your own healing and giving attention to care for the world? That's really what this whole very ancient conversation is about. How much do you care for your own liberation process? Healing process, really, is what that means. And how much do you turn your attention toward the suffering of others and wish for their well-being? And this is going to manifest in all sorts of ways throughout different Buddhist schools. In one school, there's the practice called exchanging oneself for others. Actually doing a visualization where you say, like, may I take on the suffering of other beings. And whatever privilege or benefit I have, may they have that. In its more supernatural form, you get stories like, these stories particularly appear in the Tibetan tradition. There was a Tibetan teacher, a very high up Tibetan teacher known as the Karmapa, is one of the heads of one of the several Tibetan Buddhist lineages, and the old Karmapa, who was around in the 1970s, 80s, early 90s, or into the 80s, I believe, when he was dying, he was actually dying in a hospital in Chicago. And there's a story that while he was in the hospital, he would manifest all these symptoms. His body would like go into some crazy state, and the doctor and all the alarms would go off, and doctors would run in and they'd be like, "Oh my God, he's got acute leukemia." They'd be like, "What? You know, whoa!" And they would just swing into action. But like, you know, within a half an hour, everything would settle down. Like all the systems would calm down, and they'd be like, "Wait, the tests are now coming back negative. He doesn't have leukemia." And then like, you know, a day would go by, and the next day it'd be like all the alarms would go off. They'd be like, "Oh my God, what is it? What did they do? All these tests?" and he has like stage 4 cancer of some other kind or some like terrible other disease. And that, what? Where did this come from? And it was as if, and I don't know if this how true this is. This is a story that's told by devotees, that he cycled through all these like horrendous diseases, heart disease, and all these different things, but didn't really have any of them. He just sort of showed the signs of them. And they talk about a being like that using the last moments of his life to, in a sense, purify the karma of other beings by taking on these diseases and just almost like processing them through his own body with his spiritual power. I don't disbelieve that explanation. I can't explain it scientifically. But there you go. Neither can I explain the fact that you know, there's a young man out there teaching now called the next Karmapa, the reincarnation of the last one, who is actually quite a beautiful teacher right now. He's one of the teachers talking most about social action and kind of interconnectedness in a global way, the young Karmapa. He's like 20-some now. So who knows? But that's partly where these ideas went to. It's like, oh, what if beings could actually be devoted to liberating others in this way that almost becomes magical in a strange way? So the question for us in this conversation, to bring it sort of out of the mythical and magical and even the ancient conversation, but really to ourselves, is this inquiry of, and I'll say it in terms of like a developmental process, and then let's open it to some conversation. At different points in our life or phases in our life, it seems like there's a focus that's called for, sometimes fully on ourselves and our own healing process, and sometimes on outward action in whatever way. Taking care of family or taking care of community or doing a larger body of work in the world. And it does seem, as folks practice, like our life path oscillates between these. There's times when doing the inner healing work is really all that you're about. And like, I can't even really deal with any of that. I'm really just about what's going on in therapy or what's going on in my practice. Or I'm going on retreat a lot. And other times, it's almost like I do a certain layer of healing internally. And as I do that, some amount of energy is released or some amount of clarity grows. And when that happens, like when I get out of the vortex of like, ah, I'm really struggling with this thing, it's like, oh, some clarity has come. It often feels like there's a hinge point in folks' spiritual practice where you could either take that newfound clarity or ease or kindness or concentration or a different sense of yourself, you could take it further into internal practice. And that might be like, oh, now go on retreat from this like much more resourced place and deepen in meditation in a way that you were never able to before because you were struggling with a different layer of your process. Now really take that ease into deep meditation. Or that ease, because it's often inspiring and creative when energy comes, it might turn outward and say, oh, I have ideas. I want to do something in the world. I want to contribute to this thing or get involved in this thing. And we move outward. And that will have a whole arc of work and getting involved and engaged and then at a certain point, there can be often like either something completes there and we're called to turn inward again, or very often something challenging happens in it where we either like burn out in a certain way or get disillusioned in a certain way. We join a beautiful organization that turns out to be problematic, like who knows what happens, right? We get all involved in a campaign for something and then we win it or lose it or who knows? And there can be this moment of like, oh, I need to turn inward again. It's time again to turn into taking care of this one here. My toddler has now learned to say, I need space. So I'm like, Boo Boo, what's up? Did you fall down? Did something happen? He says, and he says, no, Papa, I need space. And one day he said, "River's sad over here. Papa, go over there." So I went over a little ways, and I said, "How about here?" And he said, "No, further over there." And I said, "Okay, how about over here?" And he was like, "No, a little closer." Like he had the spot, right? He sit there, you know. It's sort of like, I can be sad over here. I want space. And then as soon as that processes, you know, if we figure out how to process it, and we do it, practice it all the time, then it's like, bing, new energy arises. And the new energy is energy for connection. So in a way, I think what we're talking about partly is the oscillation between the desire for connection and the desire for solitude. Mm-hmm. Right? What is it that we process in ourselves or learn through space and solitude and introspection? And then what is it that we process and learn and grow in through connection and contact and engagement? And then the two poles of the spectrum, the deep renunciate and the deep engaged, are really just, you know, things that we might swing through in our process. And that's true even if you went to become a nun or a monk. You know, you might be on like deep retreat for 10 years doing your inner work, but almost no one stays in deep retreat. You come out and your teacher's like, "Okay, go out, teach now. You've done enough retreat." And I know teachers that they describe coming out of, you know, 30 years of, I met this Tibetan teacher, 30 years of retreat in a cave. Solitary retreat, 30 years in a cave. People would bring food and like, wow, serious solitude. He came out at one point and his teacher was like, "Okay, now travel the world and teach." Mm-hmm. And he said, "I don't want to do that. I would rather spend the rest of my life in the cave, actually." And his teacher said, "Yeah, no, that's not right. That's not right. You've done enough in the cave." Mm-hmm. 30 years. "You've done enough. Now go out and teach." And the student, respectful student, said, "Okay, you know, you say so, I will do it." And he went out to do it, you know. That's the, in a certain way, like, that's the bodhisattva choice. It's like, okay, you vowed to do it. Go out and do it. Meet the other beings. Make contact. He was a pretty trippy guy to meet. Amazing being. Interesting. So your reflections, some space for your thoughts, particularly I think for us, just on this, some of you were like, "Oh yeah, that, you know, this thing where we balance the inward and the outward, or time in solitude, time engaged, how the spiritual path, which really just means the life path, oscillates between these types of activity." Anything you would add to that or reflect on in the course of your own life practice? Anything that we've been touching into? A more specific way to ask the question would be, almost like, how do we each resolve the tension between the process that has to go on inwardly for healing and the process that has to go on externally for connection and engagement? How do you find balance, or how do you find your way between those modes of activity? Because they are different and they both take energy, and you can't, what to say? It's always a compromise. Yeah.
I think sometimes there's like a desire to, like, I found myself showing a desire to, like, do it all, do everything.
Yeah.
You know? And then it's like, I can't, it's so overwhelming. You know? So I think, like, in that think the just like checking in, like the meditation and the inquiry, like okay, like what, like I have to be able to like have some discernment about what to let go and what is like, yeah, where does that come from? Like how do I discern like what's a priority, what's most important, what feels most true and in alignment with like my deepest, most authentic self, my heart, etc.
Right. What if it's, what if, I don't mean this to be a downer, but you know, Buddhist class is often a downer in some way. What if you can only do a few things deeply in this life? Right? Like, what if to really do something takes 20 years? Like, to get really engaged in something fully, or to have a family fully, or to become a monastic, you know, or whatever it is, like, you know, to contribute something to your field in a big way. What if that takes 20 to 50 years? And, you know, so even if we're generous, you only have three of those. If you were generous and you live a long time.
That's really generous.
That's generous, yeah. And for a lot of people, it's one. You know, like, what if you're going to do one big thing, if that? And it's not endless, you know? This, I think I see this happen often for folks kind of in their like mid to late 30s, where it's like, oh, right, that stretch where it seemed like there was a lot of time to kind of do everything, that phase of life is over. And I totally remember the feeling of like, oh, here are these things that I thought I might one day do. I will now not do them. I can just tell. It's not going to happen, you know.
That's a rough time.
That's rough, right? Because it's really forced letting go, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
Realism.
There's Middle Ages all about this. But but there's this beautiful kind of contracting kind of truth in it, right? Where you're like, oh, I have to sort of have some discernment to figure out what I really believe in doing with my time. And totally. Yeah. Yeah. But then we have to have a conversation about what worth means. Right? Is worth defined by the result? You know? Or by the experience in the moment? One might want to give a really facile New Age Buddhist answer and say that the moment is all that matters. But, you know, I spent years practicing to be a classical pianist, and I wouldn't have done it if I didn't love the momentary experience of practicing, just sitting in my room at 10 a.m., running exercises and practicing difficult passages from pieces over and over. But I would be lying if I said that that was all I wanted out of it, or that that was always satisfying in itself. You know, I spent 10 and a half months one year when I was 29 learning Beethoven's Piano Sonata Opus 111. Piano Sonata number 3, it's the E major. If you, ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. Tremendously difficult. It took me ages to learn it. And at the end of the 10 and a half months, I was practicing about 3 hours a day, mostly on that piece and other supporting things. I was about to go on a 2-month retreat. And it was the kind of piece that if it wasn't right under my fingers, I would lose it. In other words, whenever I lost 3 days of practice, I lost several weeks of facility, and I had to build it back up. Because it was like it was right on the tip of my tongue, and I couldn't read it. It was too fast. I had to memorize it. It had to be memorized in the musculature. And if I lost that for more than a handful of days, it was gone. So then I at the end of that year, I was like, oh, I'm going on 2 months to retreat. I knew in my heart that it was extremely likely that I would never play this piece again. Right? Because it would take months to get it back. And was I really going to do that? And I was really like, oh, is it worth it to have just done that? Like, what was that about? My birthday happens to be a couple days before the start of the 2-month retreat that I would regularly go on. My birthday's in the end of January. I would go on retreat for all of February and March up at Spirit Rock. And I had a birthday party. I think I was turning 29 or Yeah, it must have been turning 29. I'd practiced all my 20th year this Beethoven sonata with this great classical teacher. And I got all my friends, a bunch of friends in the house, and I said, okay, I think I'm never going to play this again, so I'm just going to play it for you right now. It's like 20 minutes long. It ends with like double trills and massive, ridiculous things. And I couldn't play it that well, but I could play it. And I was like, you know, so just like here goes. And I just like played it. And I kind of crashed through it. I made a hell of mistakes. And they were like, dude. And I was like, I know. It's crazy. And I was right. I've never played it again. I can't even sight read through it. Like, I can't even get anywhere near it. So, like, was it worth it? What was that?
It's
what was happening. Of course it was worth it. Right. Of course it was. Of course it was. But that
Could
says...
Could you possibly not have done it?
I don't know. That's a weird question about karma, right? I have no idea. I was working something out, you know. I was working it out. But it's a really deep question that you're asking, really, about, like, why do we do what we do? You know, what kind of fruition or satisfaction are we looking for when we do something?
I think that's different for everyone that you ask.
Yeah, totally.
I don't think there is a universal answer to those two questions.
I don't think so either. I agree with you. So then, like, in terms of spiritual practice or, like, working toward liberation, whatever that means, What does it get to? It's like there's something in here about like how I orient myself in this life. Like, what's my relationship to the things I'm doing, even? Why am I doing them? And, you know, for what end? Is it worth, you know, to take really a great contemporary example, like, is it worth devoting huge amounts of your energy and time to fighting to limit the catastrophic effects of climate change right now? Even though the science says that the catastrophic effects are pretty much inevitable at this point, and that mostly we're fighting about the result being tremendously bad or pretty bad. And it's like, is that worth giving your whole lifetime to? Right? Our two great climate activists are not here tonight. One of them just took a container ship to China, like went to China without flying, basically, because flying sucks environmentally, et cetera, et cetera. She just rode one of those shipping vessels across the sea to China. So Elise is there. And Anna's not here tonight. But, like, of course it's worth doing. That would be, like, incredible bodhisattva action. It brings up... you know, a kind of deep poignancy around human life that, like, oh, it would be a good thing to give your whole life to this cause, even knowing that you'll, I don't know what it means, fail? I don't know what that means. Maybe there's not such a thing, but our idea of what success is needs to evolve or change or be more mature in a certain way. Your initial question, like, is it worth doing? I think it does suggest that all sorts of things are worth doing, and I would say it is worth doing something fully. Like, lots of folks won't give 30 years to a single discipline, but a few people doing that is tremendously valuable for the world. Like, almost nobody can play that Beethoven sonata, and I can't either at this point. But the fact that there are several dozen people in the world, probably a few hundred, maybe a few thousand, I'm sure a few thousand, I don't know, not millions, who can play it, like, maybe that's good for the world, I don't know. You know. So I don't know. But this whole conversation is a little bit about these two sort of profound extremes. What's possible if you give your entire life's energy toward individual liberation? It's like, well, liberation is possible. That's what's possible. And what's possible if you give your entire life's energy over countless millennia of rebirths to the vow to save others. And the text says, well, that's also possible. So, but there are different ways to use your life energy. Yeah.
I keep thinking of what you said about river and about him having a certain placement of distance from you.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, feeling into what his need was. He needed a certain closeness to you, a certain distance from you.
Yeah.
And you've given him the space to gain a feel for that.
Yeah.
And I feel as though that has an energetic repercussion on the world. It's really wholesome for the world, for people to have that kind of discernment about themselves. And so that might mean a deep retreat for 30 years and then need to engage. But to know that impact you're going to have on the world takes a certain amount of looking inward to know what you need. And when I think of what I've heard about the Bodhisattva is you become enlightened, but you don't like go all the way until everybody's enlightened. But if you're at that point, I feel like you're so liberated that it would, there'd be a different quality about staying because there'd be that amount of liberation that it wouldn't be this profound suffering to stay to help people.
Yeah.
There'd be this, I think, a kind of ease about it.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. I think so too. I think we see this in some of the beings that are visible in their vow to save others. You know, just the saints in general.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be a contracting suffering helping others.
Yeah,
it would be
joy. Mostly these folks, you know, seem pretty happy.
Yeah.
The sort of, you know, Mandelas and Dr. Kings and Dalai Lamas of the world and, you know, the Michelle Obamas of the world. Just toss her in there. If she doesn't mind. You know, good folks who are free enough to be able to serve with some clarity of heart. All right, so we'll return to the Sutra proper next week, continue. The text goes on, very interestingly, to talk about kind of bodies of merit or blessing, and we'll talk about kind of accruing or transforming oneself or the world into bodies of blessing and merit. It's gorgeous. And I'm trying to a friend of mine named Jason Espada in San Francisco did as his own project, a project to record the entire Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines, which is a big text that this is partly based off of. And he just recorded it for his own purposes, but then he put it out on, you know, on I think as a Bandcamp CD you can download, and it's beautiful. He linked to it underneath a recent Facebook post that I wrote. So if you're friends with me on there, or you want to become that, you find that. But you can listen to it being spoken, and it's beautiful to listen to these kind of this layer of teaching being spoken. It's wild and gorgeous. And I was chatting with him on there recently, and I'm going to try to get him to come over and talk about his practice with it. The main thing that he did with it is in order to record it, he wanted to understand something about it. So he was on something like a year-long retreat with that text, and part of his practice was to record it out loud during that year-long retreat and to sit with the teachings for the year. So beautiful practice with that, and a beautiful offering to make that recording available. So you can find that, or I'll post it again sometime soon. Beautiful practice to listen to. So we'll get him in sometime soon if we can to talk about that if he wants to come over. And otherwise, take good care of yourselves. Be well out there in the inner and outer realms. Satsang is offered fully as a gift with the invitation for the gift of your resources in return. Different from what we call donation, this is really a social structure where we insist on not putting a price on something, but we also insist that the resources have to flow in order to sustain structures. So the the gift of your resources really literally makes it possible for the studio and myself to offer this in as open a way as we try to. So thank you for your generosity. And leave offerings in the box there or at the front desk for other kinds of cards and things like that. And all the talks go up on my website, and you can find them there. We'll take just a moment to sit up to close our circle. And in a way, the core reflection, one of the core reflections in this layer of practice is, that we've touched into in recent weeks, is the reflection on vastness. So again, here's a brief version. I feel myself here, and everything that I experience as a part of myself. And then I recognize that all of that is interwoven in every aspect with everyone else, in the world I live in the universe. And remembering that, immediately my attention or my perspective can go out to encompass everything, the vast universe, all beings, everyone affecting everyone else. And because of that, the whole universe available right here. As I experience myself, I experience everything in the universe because everything moves everything else. The deep liberation of the Bodhisattva is to recognize that there never was a separation between the individual and the others, but that the individual experience is always and has always already been the experience of interconnection and relationship, that there is no state outside of relationship. And perhaps that means that the entirety of the universe is one organism, one unfolding process. Realizing this is the liberation of all beings from delusion and separateness. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
See you again soon.
Thank you, Sean.
You're welcome.